Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Pure Football Podcast, the podcast that brings you the stories, tactics, stats and rumours about football in Scotland and beyond, by fans and for fans. And as ever, I'm joined by my co-host, Owen Brown. Owen, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well, Gavin. Thanks. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad. We survived another storm. We've got another podcast out, so things are looking up.
Yep.
Not too sure where I was going with that, but it's fine. On an important note, we released a survey this week, or sorry, tail end of last week actually, looking for some feedback on this very podcast. If you haven't had the chance to fill that out, then we'd really appreciate if you could take 5 minutes to go and tell us what you like, what you would like us to do more of, or what we should change, as it will really help us grow the podcast in the future. So yeah, you can find that link on Twitter. If you can't find it, then just drop me or on a DM and I'm sure we'll find you with a link. So yeah, thanks to anyone that has done that as well. Okay, Owen, so into some breaking news across youth development football. Today it was announced that there was a change to the heading of the ball regulations at grassroots level. So there will be no heading for players under the age of 12. Heading will be a low priority for ages 12 to 13 using a size 4 ball. Heading will remain a low priority for 14 to 15s, but with a size 5 ball. And then heading sessions will be introduced once a week for 16-year-olds up, and it will be using a size 5 ball as well. Owen, so the first thing I wanted to get from you with this news was, which football player's career would be over if this regulation was brought in 10, 20 years ago?
Okay, well, I decided to think about Scottish footballers for this. The obvious answer is obviously somebody like Colin Hendry. You know, you picture some Braveheart version of Hendry heading maybe not just the ball, but the man, not just the man, but the turf, the advertising hoardings, potentially his own limbs in an effort to protect the box. But that's too easy, right? Hendry comes too easily to mind. So I thought I'd come up with my own sort of preferred imagined scenario. So my preferred imagined scenario is that the person whose career this damaged the most, if it had been brought in, was somebody a lot earlier than that, talking R.S. McCall. So Robert Smith McCall played for Queen's Park, Rangers, Newcastle United in Scotland. He got 13 caps for Scotland between 1896 and 1900. He scored 13 goals, incredibly in the 10th joint highest Scotland international scorer of all time. Wow. Which is a bit of a problem for me. But anyway, the point is that the name R.S. McCall might sound familiar. And yeah, the chain of newsagents were set up by that very player and his brother. I like to imagine that all 13 of his goals were headers. And that's where the word headlines in terms of newspapers comes from, seeing as his other job was selling them. Who knows? Maybe we can pretend that's true. So R.S. McCall made the headlines by scoring all of his 13 international goals for Scotland with his head. And so, yeah, his career would have been ruined if he weren't allowed to head the ball.
I'm so into that, and I'm going to do absolutely no research into it and make sure that people believe this. So, yep, totally into that. Shout out. I was thinking, you know, again, I probably went with the more cliched, like, you know, Colin Hendry. He was the one that sort of sprung to mind because there's absolutely no way that he was a progressive centre-back taking the ball out and playing through the lines, that's for sure.
But people adapt, right? You know, so who knows? Maybe if Hendry had been given the chance, maybe if he'd been put in a position where he couldn't head it, he might have been the next Franco Baresi, some unleashed libero who was only, you know, kind of forced into the role of being a human header because of, you know, the type of football that he was in at that time.
I love that optimism. So I guess when we sort of joked a bit about the subject there, but it is quite a serious one. So what's your sort of general opinion on the sort of news and the regulation itself?
I think it's really interesting news. Like you say, this is a serious issue, and I think it's good that this is being thought about. You know, it's always positive when these things are looked at and assessed. And obviously, you know, there's major concerns in lots of sports about head injuries and, you know, the you know, concussions and things that can come from these. For me, I'm not too sure how effective this guidance is going to be. I mean, telling people not to head balls in training for under 11s or whatever, when the risks, from my understanding, is potentially for, you know, career professional footballers who've had a career of heading. I've not read the studies. I assume, of course, there's some possibility that there's more of an impact when the brain's still developing and when you're young, but I'm not too sure whether it's that evident to me that if what you want to do is reduce the risk, that just a change at that level, that age, really does that. And then, you know, the obvious kind of footballing risk is there that, you know, people are still going to have to end up heading the ball in games once they get to senior football. So, you know, how does that work? I'm just not too sure. So, yeah, I'm positive for any steps we can make in anything to, you know, reduce risk of people having, you know, terrible conditions as a result of things. Just a wee bit sceptical about what this really does. That's all.
Yeah, no, I think I feel quite similar in the sense of I'm not too sure how much this will really change things going forward. I'm also, and again, I'm absolutely like you, I've not read any of the studies or any of the papers about this sort of thing, but I'm not too sure that this is as much of a epidemic as it's being portrayed. And I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. Obviously, it's got to be taken seriously, but there's plenty of people, you know, that are, you know, in their later stages of life that are former football players that are fully compos mentis. So I think, you know, it's not necessarily just a blanket approach to this. I think there's got to be more to it, but interested to see how it goes. And it's certainly something, you know, that I'm sure we'll keep an eye on. And it's been rolled out across England, Scotland, Ireland. My worry is that if it isn't taken across the rest of, you know, the world football, then does that leave, you know, the British teams for now at a disadvantage?
Or an advantage. Now, you know, yeah, we'll develop all these ball-playing centre-backs.
yeah, watching videos of that. Yeah, watching the videos of the Twilight Zone Colin Hendry. But yeah, so let's take things back to the Scotland setup then. We spoke about Colin Hendry there, and Scotland, there's the 17s, 19s and 21s are all in action in this next week. And Owen, so let's start with the 17s, the youngest group. They're about to take on Slovakia, Republic of Ireland and the Czech Republic in the next 7 days.
And it's March, not the next 7 days.
So you're right. It's March.
Got a wee bit more time to prepare, but yeah, very, very important matches coming up for all of the age groups, 17s, 19s, 21s, and of course the senior squad, which we'll get to. So yeah, 17s first of all. So this is a qualification group for the 2020 Euros for under 17s, which take place in Estonia from the 21st of May to the 6th of June. And like you say, Scotland are into the elite round of qualification. We've got Republic of Ireland, Slovakia and Czech Republic. Top team goes straight through. The runner-up goes through if they're among the 7 best runners-up of the 8 groups. So got a pretty good chance if you come second. And to give us even more of a better chance, we are at home. So our group, Group 4, plays in Scotland. First game's at Fir Hill, Partick Thistle's ground, on the 25th of March. Then there's also matches at Capital and St Mirren, with our final match on the 31st of March. I'm pretty excited by this. I mean, I think, you know, listeners, you particularly, Gavin, would know that I've got a keen interest in kind of youth footballers, and particularly Scotland ones. So I'm very excited to go along and watch these guys, and hopefully they make it through to the tournament proper in Estonia. Yeah,
so talk me through about some of the players that you think we should be looking out for in this sort of age group.
Sure. So at the under 17 level, there's a couple of kind of names that maybe people will have heard of. So maybe the kind of first one that's made the news most is Liam Morrison, centre-back, who's gone from Celtic to Bayern Munich. Really interesting for, you know, somebody of that age from Scotland to get a chance to go to a club at that level. And, you know, kind of follows the trend to an extent of young British players going to Germany in particular to try and make the breakthrough there. Morrison's a good player, centre-back I like. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what the pathway is for him at Bayern Munich. It's obviously, you know, a long shot and a long way off to get into the senior team there at centre-back, but you would imagine that he's going to get lots of minutes at, you know, Bayern Munich 2 level and, you know, before that, below it a little bit, and then potentially, you know, you maybe look for a loan into Bundesliga 2 or something like that. Anyway, an exciting player, and yeah, if he can be turned into not exactly the kind of descendant from Colin Hendry, but more the descendant of, you know, Franz Beckenbauer, that would be lovely. In addition to him, people may have heard of Regan Thompson, who's recently gone from Queen's Park to Newcastle United. He's, you know, a really good midfielder. He seems, I don't know, he's very focused, ambitious kind of player. I like watching him. In fact, if you want to, you can go and see he scored recently for Scotland in a game in Spain, friendly game, just a couple of weeks ago or so. A little bit of a deflection on his goal, but he still really took it well. And he's somebody that I think we can kind of build play through at that age, but also as a goal threat. Somebody else who I really, really, really think people should look out for is Chris Mockery. So he's an attacking midfielder that plays for Dundee United. He's probably got a bit of a higher ceiling even than our guy Declan Glass, who, you know, you and I are both fans of, but Mockery is really hotly tipped. He should be, you know, better than Glass. He's only 16 years old at the moment. He's 2003 age group, turned 17 in April. He's been sought after by all the top clubs in the UK, but I don't know, maybe a bit of, you know, he likes where he is. He's happy to stay at Dundee United for now, but central attacking midfielder, very skillful, good at finding space. He's a goal threat as well, so really excited by him. And I guess the final one at that level, who I would say to watch out for, who maybe people aren't maybe so aware of, but I really like, is Michael Mellon. That's spelled M-E-L-L-O-N. He's a forward that plays at Burnley. Go and look him up on Instagram. He has quite a lot of clips of his goals from youth matches as kind of stories, highlights on Instagram. There's a goal that he scored from the halfway line from kickoff, which is quite fun to watch. Anyway, he looks an exciting forward, quite a natural goal scorer to me. Seems to thrive on scoring goals. Maybe the type of forward that, you know, we've not had for a little while. These guys are very young, so you need to kind of be, you know, not carried away in your expectations and stuff. Things can change, but he's yeah, exciting. So that's maybe the ones at the under 17 level I would look out for. I'm really excited to see them at the end of next month. You know, and anyone that's listening that's local, you should try and get along to those games.
I guess you know, it's interesting some of the names you picked out. I psyched myself up with this by watching Scotland get beat 2-1 off of Croatia in the under 17 games back in October. And Mockery and Thompson really stood out for me. Thompson, you know, he's really skillful. He's got really quick feet. And there's just something that he's got, that little bit of, and it's a bit of a cliche, but you know, that magic touch, and looks like he can make things happen. I feel like Mockery is quite an intelligent player in terms of the way he moves with the ball, off the ball. So those two players, you know, are definitely the ones that stood out for me. And I also want to give a shout out to Kevin Hanratty, who I think looked quite composed on the ball as well, and looks like he can offer a goal threat. So I'm interested to see how those three players do in these games coming up. And you're right, Owen, it's not in the next 7 days. These games are at the end of March, and they are all in a sort of 7-day period. One just sort of quick take from you. Do you think that's too much for these players to play, you know, three games in 7 days?
Well, I mean, there'll be lots of rotation. You know, there's quite a few people involved, and, you know, the same 11 isn't going to start each of them. I mean, yeah, personally, I would probably prefer it to be spread out over a longer period of time, but there must be reasons why that's, you know, not the case, you know, and, yeah, just time and resources and people having other matches and things. So yeah, it's a lot of games, but, you know, whatever.
Okay.
I'm happy to watch them all.
Okay, so Scotland under 19s, let's move up a level. At the same sort of period, so the end of March, they're due to take on France, Russia and Georgia. Similar thing, go and talk us through what you've sort of seen in, from this age group, and who are any of the players that we should be keeping an eye on?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is quite an exciting age group for me. I mean, there's quite a lot of... I'm quite excited generally about the young talent for Scotland. I mean, even below the under-17s, you know, 16 or below level, there's some good players too. But in terms of the 19s, this again is an elite round of qualification for the 2020 Euros. The under-19 Euros take place in Northern Ireland from the 19th of July to the 1st of August. And this is for players who are born on or after the 1st of January 2001. So we topped our initial qualifying group ahead of Germany and Belarus and Andorra. We had two wins and one draw. We only scored 5 goals, whereas, you know, Germany, were in second place, got 12. And again, we were maybe a little bit fortunate in that the qualifying was in Scotland, you know, at similar sort of places to where the 17s will be playing next month. As you said, we've got Georgia, France and Russia for our group matches, and this is in France this time, southwest of France. We played a host first on the 25th of March. In terms of this level, there are some really good players in this group for me. So I guess the standouts that I would want to talk about are Nathan Patterson, Lewis Fiorini and Kai Kennedy. Those are my favourites at this time. I mean, people can leap up in development because this is the sort of age where people should be maybe looking for senior minutes at club level. So there could be changes to this. But yeah, Patterson. So, I mean, he's been on the fringes of the Rangers squad, you know, played some minutes, I think, in the cup against Stranraer. So people may be a little bit familiar with him. But anyway, he's a 2001 born 18-year-old right back. He's, in my view, he's pretty athletic looking, tall, well built, mm-hmm. quite broad. He's aggressive on the ball. He's very confident. He, you know, captains the younger team, and you can see he's a leader. I think he could be potentially Scotland's right back for the next 10 to 15 years. But a lot of this is dependent on the pathway at Rangers. So yep. you've obviously got James Tavernier in front of him, who's a machine capable of doing, you know, 50 odd games a season. So it's difficult to get ahead of him. So Patterson's going to have a choice this summer. You know, do you stay? Does Gerrard let you leave? How much do you push it? If you don't leave on loan, I mean, then, you know, you potentially run the risk of getting, you know, just below 500 minutes dotted about the season. But, you know, if you do go away, you need to make a smart choice about where you go and make sure that you can get minutes at a level that's good enough to develop him, because he's ready for, you know, senior football at a reasonable level, I would say. Anyway, so that's some, and also you have to consider the fact that obviously people like Tavernier and, you know, Gerrard and the staff there are good to learn from. Anyway, so decision time soon for Patterson, but a very, very exciting prospect, I would say, for Scotland. In addition to that, sticking at Rangers, I guess, because there's quite a few Rangers players in this squad. The last under 19 starting 11, I think, had 5 Rangers players in the starters. Mm-hmm. The other one that I'm really excited by is Kai Kennedy. So Kai Kennedy's 17, 2002 born. He, when I've watched him in person for Rangers in Scotland, he's tended to play left wing. He's quite small in height. He has bulked up a wee bit recently, but he's diminutive, I guess you would say. I guess his main attributes are his technique. So he's smart. He can play a good pass, good vision. He's got a good long strike, despite his size. Could hit a good free kick. But the thing I would say about Kai Kennedy is the most excited I've been by him recently is when the Rangers Colts played Inverness in mm-hmm. the Challenge Cup semi-final, the infamous one with Keating's sending off that we hope is not actually considered a sending off with, once the SFA get their head out of their arse. anyway, in that match, Kennedy didn't play on the left wing. Rangers played their normal, I mean, they play a similar setup at youth level to what they do in senior, but Kennedy played as a central mid, but like a 3-8/3-10. So something like what you might imagine like David Silva would play at Man City. And he was fantastic, I think. For somebody who's 17, playing against adults for Inverness, he dominated things. He showed for the ball. He was incredibly confident. He ran the play. It really suited him to be in central areas, facing the play with time on the ball. I think the issue for him sometimes as a left winger is that he doesn't have electric pace. He's not got kind of top level athleticism the first, you know, 3 yards. So it can be difficult for him to beat his man if he's closed down close in a one-on-one situation. And then if he does get past him, he's not incredibly strong. So it can be difficult for him to get in a quality cross without maybe checking back onto his other foot. So I would love to see him play a bit more in that sort of role, and particularly for Scotland. I was having daydreams of him and Billy Gilmore kind of playing as a central attacking free eights for Scotland at some time in the future together while I watch that. But yeah, so that's the other one, Kai Kennedy. And finally for the 19s, Lewis Fiorini. He's a 2002 born 17-year-old that plays at Manchester City, midfielder, central midfielder. I really, really like this guy. So he's come back from quite a serious injury, but he's fully back and playing minutes for Man City at his age level now. He can burst from midfield. He can score goals. He can take free kicks. I'm really, really excited to see him play live. I've seen a lot of video clips, but I think he can be quite a different type of player to what we normally have. You know, he can be quite dynamic and make things happen. I would say maybe you could compare him to somebody like David Turnbull. Maybe that might be a reasonable comparison. Turnbull, of course, himself only, you know, 20 years old. But yeah, those would be the kind of standouts, I would say, for under-19s for me at the moment. And like I said, excited to see how they get on in their qualification group.
Yeah, I think, you know, just to quickly touch on the sort of Rangers connection just now, in the most recent squad there was, I think it was six Rangers players in the 19s. James Maxwell, Nathan Patterson, Kieran Dixon, Kai Kennedy, Josh McPake and Dapo Mabud. You alluded to the Inverness game. I thought the Rangers Colts actually gave a really good account of themselves. You know, against a pretty good Inverness team. You know, they're second in the championship. That's no mugs. Inverness put out what would be their first team. And I think there's a lot of positives there. But again, you're spot on with it. The key is, can they get minutes at a higher level? You mentioned obviously Patterson and Kennedy, but I quite liked the way Mabud played up front in that game as well. I thought he'd done well pulling into the channels, and you know he got a few pretty heavy tackles and bounced back. So you know I like to see that resilience from younger players because they can sometimes you know go into their shell if they get a heavy challenge. So I thought that was good sort of character from Dapo.
Tough conditions, you know, it was incredibly rainy, sticky pitch, and like you said, yeah, there was plenty of kind of not necessarily dirty challenges, but it's just the type of pitch, the type of weather that makes it happen, and you're right, bounce back up and he did reasonably well, I thought, Mabud.
And just one final quick name from me, I want to give a shout out to Jack Stretton, who's at Derby County. I watched some clips of him at the weekend by complete chance, not knowing that I would speak about him. And he's got 9 goals in 11 games for Derby. I think it's in the Premier League under-19s or under-18s. I can't remember exactly what it is, but he's having a really good season and just a name that we should keep an eye on. Quite positive about the 19s. You think, you know, quite a few of these will be able to make the step up then in sort of general terms, or is it still a wait and see for you?
I think it's hard to tell. I guess, well, we can play a wee game on that. So do you have any guess as to which player? It's in fairly recent memory because we haven't had an under-19 squad for that long. Which player do you think has the most caps ever for the Scotland under-19s?
Under-19s? Couldn't tell you off the top of my head. That you've got
guess how many under-19 caps they had. What's the highest that somebody's had for the 19s?
10?
Well, it's 13. And guess how many senior caps that person has?
0.
Yeah, correct. Callum Booth, St Johnston, now age 28, got 13 caps under-19 level, no senior caps. So it's good lesson maybe to be mindful about expectations. You know, people can point to number of caps, people can point to number of goals, you know, things like Fraser Hornby getting so many goals for the under-21s, but you need to dig into the granular detail of these things and understand, you know, what's the context. Did somebody get so many caps because maybe somebody that's better than them got bumped up to the next level? You know, who are the goals against? I guess in relation to that as well, top scorer for the under-19s is Alex McDonald, who now plays for Mansfield Town in League 2. He's had 108 games for them and he's only scored 6 goals for them. He went on, got 6 Scotland under-21 caps, but only scored 1 goal against Luxembourg and, of course, hasn't had any senior caps. So, yes, I'm excited about many of these players, and I think certainly some of them will go on and have a really good career in football. I think there will be, out of this clutch, the current under-19s, maybe, you know, three that can go on and play for the senior squad, which should be a pretty good return, I think. You know?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I guess one sort of quick question I had for Johan was, what would be your opinion on, and again, a sort of higher level, maybe the over-reliance on academy players? Do they get, or in your opinion, do they get preferential treatment over maybe players that are playing more regularly but maybe not for a bigger club?
It's hard to tell, isn't it? But I think that might be a fair thing to state. I think there can be definite benefits in terms of having people in who play at, you know, bigger clubs, swisher facilities, and are more established. But yeah, that needs to be balanced up with the benefit of people getting actual senior minutes against, you know, adults in a league. I guess a good example of somebody that we both like is Kieran Bowie, who, you know, you might hope to see in a Scotland squad, but he's not, you know, despite getting full, you know, senior minutes for Raith Rovers quite a lot. And maybe that is because there's, you know, certain favouritism shown to players at bigger clubs. Maybe it's something else entirely. For me, maybe in terms of Bowie, I think maybe he just maybe slightly too young for this cycle. I think that maybe once a qualification cycle is established with people in it, it's maybe a wee bit hard to break in. But maybe once his move to Fulham goes through, and if, you know, this European Euro 2020 campaign, maybe he could get into the 19s at that point. But yeah, in general, it's maybe something to look out for. Maybe there is a bit of favouritism for players at elite bigger academies. What do you think?
Yeah, I'm of a similar opinion. I think that, you know, it's all well and good if the player is playing, but they have to be contributing. And I think in the case of Bowie and Dylan Tate, both are contributing at a, you know, a pretty good level, I think. And it's also worth noting that I think Chris Hamilton, one of the defenders who's on loan at Cowdenbeath from Hearts, is playing, and he's in the squad. So, you know, is he there because he's at Hearts and their academy, or is it because he's playing regularly from Cowdenbeath? Don't know, but I do feel like there's maybe scope to have more players in the squad that are playing at a higher level. That, to me, that feels like they're going to progress quicker, you would imagine.
Yeah, potentially. It's a good question to ask, I think.
Yeah, so let's keep going up with our trajectory, mm-hmm. and let's move to the 21s. So Scotland 21s, their next game is against Croatia on the 27th of March. Mm. And then they play Greece, I think it's on the 31st, straight after that. How do you feel about our 21s crop just now, and are you as confident in them?
No, I'm a bit nervous. These two matches are absolutely pivotal. So, you know, the Scotland under 21s are in a situation where they had a good start to their group stage. This is qualification for the 2021 Euros, which don't happen until the 9th of June 2021. And this is for players born on or after the 1st of January 1998. We had some good press around when we won away to Croatia 2-1. But I think since then, things haven't been totally great for me. So we lost to Greece 1-0. We drew at the Czech Republic 0-0. We had a 0-0 draw at home, with Lithuania. You know, then there was that Croatia win, which I think got people excited. We beat, San Marino 2-0 at home, but that game was a bit of a grind. And I think that at this moment in time, we're third on the table, 2 points ahead of Croatia, 2 behind Greece, and 3 behind the Czech Republic. But Croatia and Greece both have a game in hand. So these two games against them are absolutely pivotal even. For me, my concern with the under-21s is actually watching them and seeing what they're doing. I'm not that happy with the way they're playing. I think that they really, really struggle to create chances. For me, I think I've said, you know, I've watched a lot of them under Scott Gemmell, and I'm not exactly enamoured with the style and the way that they play. I think there are also some gaps in the squad, which maybe make it difficult for them to make chances. So there's a lack of fullbacks, really, particularly right back, to the extent that Kyle McGinnis, before his kind of career season-ending injury, was filling in at right back, and sometimes it had been Ross McCrory at right back and so on. Both not natural right backs in my view, and you know, quite an important position in terms of opening up the pitch and creating chances. I also think up front that as much as I want Fraser Hornby to succeed, and I'm really, you know, happy that he's done something to challenge himself, like, you know, go to Belgium, I think that maybe he got a little bit overrated with the number of goals that he scored, when some of those were against much lesser opposition and kind of crammed into, you know, single games, and not necessarily indicative of us being able to create chances again of that same style. And I also think that despite the fact that we've got some really good wingers, like Middleton, McLennan, Mikey Johnston played at that level as well, at times we don't really use them. Middleton played the last few games through the middle as essentially a centre forward. I don't understand that. It's not his role at all. Wee bit nervous about the potential results in these next two games. And overall, as much as there's a smattering of good players in the group, some real standout players, I'm not too sure that we're doing that great at that level in this current campaign, really, for me. What about you?
I'm much the same. I'm not a fan of Scott Gemma at all, to be honest. I think there's a lot of correlation, I think, or not correlation, that's the wrong word, but there's a lot of similarities between the way that Aberdeen play with Sam Cosgrove up front and the way that Scotland and the 21s play when they play Fraser Hornby up front. I think watching the Greece game back, the amount of direct balls that were launched up to Hornby was criminal, especially when, you know, Greece went down to 10 men. And it, for, you know, having some really good players in that age group, I think you're right. I think we lack ideas in terms of how we're going to break teams down. And, you know, it really worries me as well that we're saying that, you know, I think there was only 5 defenders called up in total across the 4 positions in the last squad. That to me is an alarm bell in itself. I think that shoehorning players in, you know, we've got a lot of central midfielders just now. Mm-hmm. So what's the purpose in calling up, you know, 6-7 central midfielders when, you know, realistically you're probably going to use 4?
That to me is absolutely something I would agree with. You know, what's the point there? Are you calling people up out of a sense of loyalty, just because they've been in there, when, you know, really you need to, you know, actually address the problem positions and make sure a squad's got structure to it. I guess the other thing I would say about what you were saying about the kind of long ball up to Hornby is I kind of fear that the kind of success that we had at Toulon, when he was playing up front and he was flanked by Burke and Mikey Johnston, has maybe led to that a little bit, because at that level, Burke and Mikey Johnston were so much better than anybody else they were playing against, in a physical sense, really. Burke with, you know, power and pace, and Johnston with acceleration and technique, that we were quite happy to essentially launch it up to Hornby, but then he would flick it on round the corner for one of those two. But that doesn't necessarily work when you don't have either of those two guys, Johnston or Burke, and the physical mismatch isn't there anymore, as the other teams get older and develop too, and people, you know, kind of even out a wee bit, and we don't have somebody that's an athletic freak. I agree with you entirely. I think the criticism again was fair. I think the thing I was looking at, and again, you know, I have a lot of respect for the people that fill these roles and do these things, and it's, you know, obviously a difficult job, and, you know, they're all clearly very good coaches. But I was kind of looking at the history of who has coached each of these age groups, and people do bounce around a lot, you know, between the under 21s, the under 19s, the under 17s. It's the same kind of wee pool that seems to be covering these roles over a long period of time. And that's not necessarily a great thing. I mean, I think it's difficult to attract people into these roles, probably because they don't necessarily lead to, you know, you know, to you then getting a good job in club football or anything, or at least that's not historically how it's been. So I guess they need to think about how they attract the best candidates into these jobs. I mean, I know, you know, down south, what's his name, the Swansea guy? So, Steve Cooper.
Yeah,
so he's gone from managing the England under-16s and under-17s very successfully to then get a, you know, a top-level job at Swansea. So, you know, it's not impossible, but I think you maybe need to show how that can happen and then attract people in that might then want to, you know, play perhaps better and more expansive football in the final third and get these under-21s where they potentially can go. There are some good players in there, obviously, you know, Billy Gilmore and some other people that are very high quality.
I guess it is a tough one, and it does feel a little bit incestuous in terms of Scotland youth coaching pool. A quick question I wanted to put to you. So I know I was maybe critical about too many midfielders, too many central midfielders, but there's one player that is missing for me just now, and that's Ali McCann from St Johnstone. I feel like so I know there's been conversations about he's potentially going to switch for Northern Ireland. I was looking at some of the names in the squad just now for the Scotland under-21s, and I would have McCann over at least Dean Campbell, Barry Maguire and Ewan Henderson, just based on how well he's performing for St Johnstone. Do you find it a bit odd that he's not near that setup at all?
Well, he's playing for Northern Ireland, so I think it's just the case that he doesn't want to. As far as I'm aware, his dad's Northern Irish and his mum's English. That's his choice, as who he plays for. I think that he's already up in the Northern Ireland under-21s, and he played for them through October and November last year. So probably we've missed out on him. I don't know if he was on the radar at younger age groups or not. It doesn't look to me as though he was in the Northern Ireland kind of younger setup. So, you know, maybe he's just been a wee bit of a late bloomer and they've managed to get him in at the right time. But we've probably missed out on him.
Yeah.
I'd say. If there's potentially a way of convincing them, I think that, you know, these games, the two at the end of the March for the under-21s, it could be a bit of a sliding doors moment for a lot of people. You know, if we lose those and we're out of contention, then it's essentially a write-off for the last three or whatever games it is of this campaign, which don't start again until, I think, September. So at that point, you maybe have a phase-out and a rejig. And then, you know, if McCann's interested, then obviously you would try and get him in. You know, he's a very good player. I like him a lot. But at this down time, it's, you know, his choice, you know.
So are you saying that you can't influence him for me? Can you?
I'll see what I can do. No, I have absolutely no influence with him.
Oh, that's disappointing. I was really hoping you had a sway in the McCann household, but
I don't think so.
Okay, so let's move up to the senior squad, just sticking with the national team. So we've got a crucial game against Israel, and we're going to do something a little bit different when we're discussing the senior team. So everything we're going to discuss about the senior team is relating to listener questions, which comes from the Pure Football post box, as Byron Hutchison from the Europod called it. Rather than a mailbox, we're going to have a post box. And the first question for you comes from at Front Post Football. Should we consider a 3-5-2 against Israel? A number of our players are now playing in this way, such as McBurney, Fleck, Griffiths and Forrest. What would you think?
I think it's an interesting thought. I think there's no chance that Clark does this because he's, you know, quite clearly a four at the back kind of manager. I think that some of our players do fit it, as pointed out, but I think it's tougher to defend in a five at the back in some ways, in terms of handovers between players. It's just less of a natural, kind of quick to understand set up in terms of your tracking, passing over men. I also think there's just little time to train these things at international level, so I don't think it would be appropriate to change now. And the other reason why I wouldn't do it is that Israel play with five at the back. as sort of a 5-3-2, 5-3-1-1. And I think that we would want to ideally overload them on the flanks. Their left wing back essentially is, particularly from the things I've watched, somebody to try and break the ball through. So I'm going to try and get in behind them. And I think if we play a 5-3-2, then that limits our chances on the wings. It's a no from me, but I don't hate the shout moving forward, maybe if we wanted to look at it after these games.
Cool. Okay, so let's move on to the next question, which came from Kev Wilson 08, who asked...
The other reason I have a problem with 5-3-2 for Scotland is distribution from the back. I think if you're going to play 5-3-2, you need to have a centre-back who's comfortable bringing the ball out of defence and progressing in that way. And I would just worry too much that we would lump up the park, particularly if we went back to Marshall, and we just put it straight up and it would just come straight back.
Yeah, I can already see that one panning out exactly as you just described it, especially given Scott McKenna's distribution this season. As I mentioned, at Kev Wilson 08, he asked, do we consider introducing longer-term prospects such as McCrory, I'm assuming he means Robbie, Lyndon Dykes and Billy Gilmore, or should we stick with what we know for now?
Do you take this to mean in this game?
I think it means in this squad, potentially, right, including the Norway, if we get there.
Okay, well,
assuming Norway win as well.
I mean, not to be too negative about the thoughts our listeners have, because I do really appreciate them, but it's another no for me. Just because Clark will not do that, there's absolutely no chance of that for this, and also that I don't think he should for this game. I mean, Clark's quite a loyal guy. He has, you know, clearly kind of shown that through his selection. He's not going to rip things up at any point, really, I think. But he's certainly not going to rip things up in the most kind of important match that is, you know, he's basically having in his career. And I think that there's a value to having the people in that, you know, we've already had in that experience, that connection. I also think that it's not time for Gilmore. I love Billy Gilmore. I think he's going to be a key player for Scotland in the future. But it wouldn't be right to put him into this team. There's loads of midfielders who are ahead of him at the moment. You know, once he gets some senior minutes next season, then that's the time for him to kind of elevate. After this match, if we don't go through, then it can be a kind of sliding doors moment, and we can see lots of, you know, phasing out and phasing in and stuff, but not for this game. No way for me. It could potentially ruin somebody's career if they come in inexperienced and then something goes wrong. I guess in terms of the other people mentioned, well, for me, as much as, you know, everybody knows that I really like Lyndon Dykes, I don't necessarily know if he's quite good enough for Scotland at this point, or if he's really a stylistic fit for what I think Clark wants to do. So I'm not sure if I see that one either. As much as we do have a, you know, not a great amount of centre forwards, there's more options than would mean that he would be one of the three or four that are going to be selected, in my view.
Okay.
So that's my kind of overall feel, that I think that, you know, the squad is there, and it's after these matches, not at this match, that you would look to alter things significantly.
So I guess I maybe slightly disagree with you in terms of Lyndon Dykes. He's the only one. I think the rest of their time will come. But I feel like I would take Dykes in the squad, assuming that he would be interested in a call-up for Scotland. Just based on the options available, I would rather Lyndon Dykes than Mark McNulty. I would rather Lyndon Dykes than Eamon Brophy. I would rather him than Ollie Burke.
But you've got to consider this from Clark's perspective and who Clark knows. We both have fairly similar views about Brophy and Burke, but, you know, Clark is... worked with both of them for a long time, you know, and knows what they can deliver, and knows that they, you know, understand his tactics and stuff. So I think that's got to play into your, you know, your choices. The other thing you've got to consider as well is what that does to their relationships. It's a bit more complex than just saying, well, yeah, see you, Brophy or whoever, and we'll get in Dykes. It's not as cut and dry as that, because then you've got to think, well, if it doesn't work out for Dykes in this game and we decide he's not for this level, then, you know, can I go back to Shankland or Brophy or whoever I leave out? You know, is there going to be a problem with the trust now that I've essentially said, you know, decided that you're not even good enough to be my fourth choice? you shouldn't care? Is that what, you know?
I feel like that to me should be based on a number of factors, and if you have the right conversation with the player should understand that,
sure,
you know, maybe they're not the right fit for that moment in time, or, you know, I think, for example, you're right, Eamon Brophy knows Clark's system and what his expectations would be, but I have a horrible feeling that Mark McNulty is going to be in this squad, and I really don't fancy that at all. Mm. I think Mark McNulty really flatters to deceive in terms of his actual contribution. I can see that coming, and that worries me. But hopefully, you know, McBurnie, Shankland, Griffiths, in fact, Griffiths won't be in the squad, will he? Because he's not available for selection.
He might be interesting. I would like it if he was in.
Oh, absolutely.
But yeah, the risk is that he maybe gets told he's not going to be a starter, because I think Clark might stick with Naismith. But yeah, we'll see.
Okay, so let's keep this ball rolling then. At Andrew 1869 asks, how do we replace John McGinn?
Okay, for me, with Ryan Christie. So what does McGinn bring? Well, he brings dribbling, ball carrying, he wins fouls, he presses, and he's got a kind of knack of being in the right place at the right time for goals. I guess your options are Christie, Naismith, or Armstrong. For me, the guy that most captures each of those things is Ryan Christie. I think he can press from the front. He can be the sort of guy that transforms it from a 4-3-3 or a 4-2-3-1 into a sort of 4-4-2 out of possession and press with a centre forward. He'll get you goals. He is, you know, aggressive through the centre. So yeah, that's the choice for me. That's how I would try and replace John McGinn.
Okay. And the final listener question came from Cameron Gemmel 3. Do we honestly have a chance, consider we have Norway / Haaland, should we get to the final? I guess that's obviously a caveat, and if Norway beat Serbia. But Owen, quickly, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, can I be a manager and say one game at a time, please? I mean, come on, that's the way we've got to approach it. There's no point thinking about that when we still get Israel in front of us. Israel are a good team. I think we can beat them. Like I said, they play in a 3-5-2, sort of 3-5-1-1. Kind of set up. Look, they came, way down. I think they came fifth out of a 6-team group in this, you know, qualification round. So they're beatable. We can get at them, but they've got key dangers. Minister De Boer and Zahavi up front are both really good. I saw De Boer play for Salzburg against Celtic, and he's really good at being able to pin a centre back and take the centre back wide. And make space through the middle for, you know, midfield runners to come through and so on. So I'm a little bit worried about Israel. So let's deal with getting through them first. After that, we can face the horror show that is Haaland and Odegaard running at our defence.
I will answer your question, Cameron, and the answer is no. Simple as that. If Haaland has to play against Scott McKenna or Declan Gallagher or another, we will get destroyed. There's a nice positive ending to our Scotland national team set-up coverage. loads of things going on with the Scotland set-up. A lot happening in March. So it's going to be a busy few weeks for us in the last sort of couple of weeks of March.
A Steve Clarke interview coming, so listen out for that. That'll be good. You'll hear that before the matches, hopefully. But go on, Gavin, what were you going to say?
Yeah, so I was just going to... say we're going to finish up tonight by previewing, hopefully, some more coefficient gravy. Rangers and Celtic both played last week in Europa League and got some pretty good results. Rangers won 3-2 at home versus Braga. I guess the most important thing was they got a win from 2-0 down. And Celtic drew 1-1 with Copenhagen and got that vital away goal. And Fraser Forster also made a crucial penalty save right at the end. Owen, do you want to give me just a quick summary of what you've seen between these two games in the first leg, and then sort of any predictions or things that we should look out for in the return leg?
Absolutely. So Celtic Copenhagen, I guess, was a game of two halves, really. So we've got the return leg on Thursday. I think that the first half for Celtic was obviously really, really good. They were dominant. They were getting through. They were making chances for Edward. And I think that's reflected in the kind of stats for this game. So Celtic got 2.09 XG, whereas Copenhagen from open play got 0.75. They obviously added a penalty, which is 0.76 XG. So Celtic pretty dominant, 14 shots to 6. But like I said, game of two halves. First half, Celtic got loads of chances through on goal for Edward. Second half, I felt like Copenhagen changed things quite a lot. I'll probably tweet out some pass maps later on, which you can then see what I mean by this. But essentially, Copenhagen decided to push the fullbacks higher, particularly on the right side. I think the guy's name is Varea. And then Zeka, who's the kind of ball winner and kind of dominant guy in midfield, became a lot more dominant, and that really helped them. They squeezed the middle, overloaded it, and then switched it quite often to the fullbacks. They were really able to exploit Frimpong, so the left-sided attacker came inside a lot, and Frimpong didn't know what to do. Effectively kind of followed him all the way to where the centre-back should really be picking him up, didn't communicate with the midfield or the right-sided midfielder, and that left the left wing-back really free. And quite similar happened on the other side at the same time, but Hayes' real problem was just giving the ball away. He was very, very sloppy with his passing and turned it over a lot. In addition to that, Celtic started sitting really deep, and Julien did really well in terms of defending in the box, but it was just inviting pressure, and it was making a real gap between Celtic's midfield and defence in possession, so they couldn't ever really get up the pitch. So that was kind of interesting to me. It'll be interesting to see whether they revert to the 3-5-2 for the home leg. They did that against Kilmarnock at the weekend, and after a wee bit of a shaky start where they conceded a penalty and a goal, it looked to be really, really good. Maybe one of the factors to that was that they played McGregor at the base of the 3-5-2 midfield, and they could move the ball really quickly. I felt that in the first leg, certainly in the second half, Scott Brown got a little bit exposed for athleticism. He was getting bypassed too easily. He'll definitely play in the home leg, and I'm sure he'll be a key man, but it'll be interesting to see how that midfield works. Also felt at the weekend for Celtic, Ryan Christie played in a central attacking midfield role, and he was really, really good, always very involved. I think, as much as he scores spectacular goals cutting in from the right wing onto his left foot, for me, his best role is through the middle, where he can press, where he can be aggressive and dynamic. So, be interesting to see how that works out. I think Celtic need to play to their strengths, and I think they will, and I think this will be really difficult for Copenhagen. I think Celtic are definitely much better than them. Copenhagen need to score. That will open up gaps, and Celtic will win 2-0.
Love it. I feel really confident in this game as well. The final question I had for you in relation to Celtic, Bolly, Hayes or Taylor, left back?
Taylor's got the role for now. I think he's done well recently, made lots of chances against Kilmarnock from what I saw. For me, I still prefer Bill O'Nolly. I know I'm a little bit out on an island with my opinion on that, but I think that Taylor's quite predictable in terms of the way he beats people. He likes this little rollback where he puts his foot on top of the ball and then kind of pulls it around. He struggles when he's pressed aggressively when passing lanes are closed down. I think Bolognoli, as much as things can sometimes go wrong for him with his passing, that's because he likes to go for a more kind of high-risk, high-reward pass. He loves those little diagonals into Meacham, but then he can really combine well with the midfielder. He knows how to combine well. Taylor's learning that. Taylor's getting better. Taylor's really good defensively, and he's a great crosser of the ball, so he's a really good option. For me, as long as it's not Hayes, that's probably a good thing for Celtic. That would be my ultimate view on that one.
carry on.
Well, I was just going to are we going to move on to Rangers and discuss the game against Braga?
Yep, you read my mind. So we're going to Portugal at 5 o'clock on Wednesday. Talk me through what you've seen in the first leg of this one, Owen.
Well, this was some game, wasn't it? Absolutely incredible. I think you and I had watched a fair bit of Braga before the game and kind of knew, I guess, what to expect. 3-4-3, very, very good in transitions, deadly down the wings, love an overload, love a through ball. I think we saw that in the first half. It was very difficult for Rangers, but we also saw the kind of deficiencies for Braga, that very high line and Morelos getting through quite a bit. I think a real positive for Rangers, obviously, that they were able to come back and, change things up and get some incredible strikes to win it. I think what you would have to say probably is that those goals were a bit lucky. I mean, obviously incredible strikes, but for instance, the Hagi free kick, as much as Hagi is clearly capable of these things, you wouldn't necessarily expect that sort of thing to happen every game. And in terms of expected goals, Braga dominated that by 2.08 to 1.41. Braga didn't make anything after an hour, and that's partly just down to game state. You know, maybe they were a bit tired too. Anyway, so, you know, 3-2 for Rangers. Brilliant, brilliant win. I think that the second leg is going to be tough. So Braga are still third in the Portuguese league. I watched some highlights of their game at the weekend. They beat Setúbal 3-1. They were pretty dominant in that. They had 24 shots to Setúbal's 6. Although Setúbal did exploit their very high line a couple of times. There was a goal ruled out for offside, and they got back to 2-1 with a goal that was a kind of through ball against that high line. On the other hand, Braga scored a very stereotypical Braga goal to open the scoring. Counter-attack, through ball behind the full-back, cut back, bang, goal. So there's a lot for Rangers to watch out for. I think particularly given those two away goals for Braga, it's going to be tough. I think, you know, Rangers will have learned a lot from the first game, you know, in terms of how to play against them. I think they did lots of good things in the second half when they were a bit more aggressive and stepped up against the press. But they're going to have to be really mindful of the threat in behind their full-backs. And they're going to have to be clinical when these chances against the high line arise. For me, probably, let's be brave. Okay, I'm going to say it's going to end 2-2 and Rangers will go yes. through. Right? I think there's going to be goals in this game from Absolutely. Both sides. And 2-2 and the gravy will flow forth.
That's exactly what we want to hear. A couple of quick questions for me then on this game. So Cambéry's obviously going to start up front, you would imagine, with Morelos being suspended. Mm. Do you think he'll be able to have an impact?
Well, I mean, he had quite an impact at the weekend with a pretty remarkable finish. I hope he does. I think that he, for me, he's an inconsistent kind of player, or at least that's what I feel when I saw him at Hibs. I think it will be interesting to see if he can show a level of consistency. And when he's through on goal, he needs to be able to be clinical. You know, there's going to be a very specific type of chance I think he'll get. You know, high line, running through on his own, lots of time to think, in a kind of high-pressure environment. So let's see. Yeah, I mean, it's a good chance for him to deliver and potentially secure a permanent deal. You know?
Yeah. Okay. And I guess the final one, let's assume Barisic doesn't make it. You've got the choice of Joe Aribo, Andy Halliday, or not playing a left back. What are you doing?
that's quite a question. No chance for John Flanagan.
No chance for
joking,
John Flanagan.
Joking. Can we bump James Maxwell up from the under 18s? I think probably you would go Halliday for security in that case. You have to keep in mind those two away goals and the threat in behind. You know, they tell you how they play, right? That's the threat. Do you really want Joe Aribo? It's a very different scenario to play Joe Aribo from the start of this game for 90 minutes potentially away with Rangers marginally ahead, as opposed to, you know, with half an hour to go, stick him at left back to try and make things happen and turn things around in the first leg. So for me, you need to be a little bit more conservative and go for Halliday. This is a potentially season-defining week for Rangers. You know, I think they need, that's the thing to keep in mind. You know, they're now multiple, possibly 10 points behind Celtic. You know, have the Europa League to try and stay in, and then Hearts away in the Scottish Cup quarter-final at the weekend. It's absolute crunch time, so I would tend to not take that sort of risk. And anyway, I as much as people are saying that Aribo did well at that role, and he did fine for stretches against St Johnston as well, I'd rather have him higher up the pitch. You know, that's where he's effective.
Yeah, it's definitely a tough one.
What are you saying? Who are you playing in that situation?
I'm going Aribo. I'm not playing Andy Halliday at left back. I think I've seen some pass maps from Rangers against St Johnstone at the weekend, and it just makes the full system ineffective. I think you can count on one hand the amount of times that he overloaded past Kent, and that then makes Kent null and void. So I think it actually has a detrimental impact to Rangers. I think at least with Aribo, you know that he is going to offer the threat going forward. Maybe, you know, go back to Kamara and say, right, this is your game to get, you know, prove that you're good enough, and, you know, really have him as the defensive mid with Jack and Davis. That maybe gives Aribo that freedom. If you have that security blanket there to support them, it's going to be a difficult game regardless. But let's, you know, end it on a positive note that the coefficient gravy is going to flow. Mm. And, you know, if you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, then one, thank you so much for tuning in. Secondly, if you can tell a friend. Thirdly, if you didn't remember at the start, I said we've got a survey, and if you can go and do that, that would be awesome. And yeah, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back again soon.
Thanks, bye-bye.